My name is Kyle Clears. I'm the Associate Director of the Kauffman Interfaith Institute at Grand Valley State University. It's a sincere privilege to be invited to be with you all to explore this theme of human connection. It's so pivotal to our work in the interfaith space. What I'd like to share with you all is a reflection on the process, the path, by which we find ourselves on this journey of coming alongside of our neighbor and understanding those around us. And of course, there are many ways to do that. My reflection this morning will primarily focus on sort of the spiritual, the interfaith, the worldview, the value dimension of that work. On the night of the 2016 U.S. presidential election, while doing the Late Show and simultaneously watching the results come in, Stephen Colbert noted the Pew Research, which showed that about half of Democrats, 55%, say that the Republican Party makes them afraid, while about 49% of Republicans would say the same thing about Democrats. He remarked, "Both sides are terrified of the other side." Maybe that's why our voting booths have curtains, so you have a place to hide when the election's over. So how did our politics get so poisonous, he asked. Maybe we overdosed, he suggested. We drank too much of the poison. You take a little bit of it so you can hate the other side, and it tastes kind of good. You know, you like how it feels. There's a gentle high to the condemnation because you know you are right. We allow ourselves to be afraid of people who are different, even hate them, because there is that gentle high we find in condemning them. But there can also be a high in the desire to win, to be right, without any thought of the consequences. In our interfaith dialogue spaces, the consequences of trying to win are very real. In a country and community that has become increasingly polarized, entrenched in survival-based tribalism, echo chambers, our propensity to develop and vehemently protect group identities galvanizes our resistance towards moving toward the so-called other. Certainly, this group needs no reminder of that. Whether philosophical or religious, partisan, or socioeconomic, racial, or gender, these group identities have their own narratives, their own rituals, their own languages. They have their own bumper stickers, their own hashtags, their own social media outlets, and like-minded friends and followers on social media. These identity markers often perpetuate the we and the them categories that all too often color the lenses through which we view our neighbors. You see, amid my fear and anxiety, amid my trying to win you over to my side, amid my discomfort, disorientation, and frustration associated with disagreement, I lose sight of you as a person. I all too often become so enamored with my own sense of self-righteousness that I, in fact, have it politically, faith, reason, morality, family, whatever it might be, all figured out, and I know precisely how that ought to be lived out, that I entrench myself in the issues at hand and lose sense of others, the people around me. Now, amid all of our positions, amidst our having it all figured out and condemning those who think otherwise, we've simply seen far too little of one another. We've become unable to see and learn from the humans around us. But in interfaith spaces, there is no doubt that we're very different. But that difference, it's not to be overlooked or simply ignored because we think it's satisfying and comfortable in the moment. No, in fact, the difference can be quite life-giving if we engage it through healthy interaction and dialogue. And true dialogue, like any relationship or journey, is nuanced and complex, challenging, and deeply rewarding. We can call this process the interfaith agenda, if you will. You can imagine it like a ladder, right, with different rungs leading to the next step, perhaps like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, a series of pillars that support a larger culture and community of peace. I will say that each of us may identify with different pieces of the interfaith agenda, and that's okay. In fact, I find that with different groups or individuals, I might find myself at a different place. The agenda simply offers us a gauge by which we can see the choices we make in the peacemaking process. For today, I want to talk about the interfaith agenda as a path, a journey along which we will encounter six persons, or postures, if you will, that each play a part in the choices we make on the way towards peace, towards human connection. I love to hike, so I invite you to take a deep breath and imagine with me. Imagine that we are traveling through a dense woods along a meandering dirt path. It's well-worn, but narrow, and not terribly obvious to those who aren't on the trail. We're looking for water. The campsite in which we are staying has a broken well. We, along with the traveling companions we left back at camp, are thirsty after a hot day of hiking. As we set out on the path, we round a bend and come across a steep rock face rising up next to us. Gazing up, we see our first persona. Their name is Tolerance. They look down at us from atop their fortified ledge. "I don't like you, stranger, and I sure as heck don't want you here," Tolerance yells. "You have a right to be in these woods, just the same as me, so I'm not going to harm you, but I'm not sharing my water with you. Find your own. Maybe if you weren't so foolish or had planned ahead, you wouldn't be in this position." I'm sure many of us have seen the coexist bumper stickers lettered out of adaptations of the different faith symbols and philosophical traditions. Tolerance, or coexistence, is absolutely a necessary first step in this interfaith process. Like any journey, often the first step can be the most difficult. It wouldn't take us much time to journey in our minds I to places around the world, maybe around the country or this community, where people are incapable of living alongside of one another as neighbors. To the extent that healthcare, economics, education, safety, even the right to exist are withheld from the other. Ensuring that people's lives are not under threat is absolutely essential, but to simply stop at, "We disagree, but I'll let you live here and promise not to harm you, seems somewhat lacking. Think of it like this. In the world of medicine, tolerance is often discussed along with treatments like chemotherapy, for instance. How much of a foreign substance, a particularly and potentially harmful presence, can be tolerated before it harms us? While tolerance seeks to avoid violence and harm, it also stops at avoiding violence and harm. It is a minimal legal position and a value base, but is hardly the goal of human connection. There's no desire for the other person. With this first and hardest step underfoot, we must continue, therefore, on the path. At the bottom of a hill, we come to a small spring. Sitting on a log between the water and us is a second person. This is hospitality. "Come, stranger, sit with me and have a quick drink. You look thirsty." This persona welcomes us into their space and gives us a cool glass of spring water. As we finish our glass, hospitality remarks, "Thank you for stopping by. I've enjoyed our time together. This was far too short. I hope we get to do it again soon." The core of the word hospitality is the Latin notion of receiving a stranger. The work of receiving another requires a degree of vulnerability, does it not? In his book, When Faiths Collide, Martin Marty challenges us not to settle for tolerance, but to take the aggressive risk of hospitality. And I love that phrase. What does it mean to approach hospitality as an aggressive risk? This means that I allow somebody into my life, into the spaces that are familiar and comfortable to me, knowing that this person or persons represents a belief system, a worldview, a culture, an experience that could be vastly different than my own, perhaps even challenge the notion that mine is the only truth. For Marty, hospitality permits us to be risk takers in the ways we are present to and welcoming to people, even though they seem vastly different. It's very easy and comfortable to remain isolated in our tribes, fortified in our echo chambers, but hospitality allows us to venture out of those safeties and securities even as we welcome others in. Certainly, many sacred and significant texts speak of welcoming, caring for, and acting generously toward the stranger. While welcoming people into our homes and sharing a meal or a glass of beverage is a wonderfully human way to begin a relationship, it doesn't necessarily mean that we have entered into the story or experiences of the other person. So our journey continues. Soon after finding hospitality on the path, we come to a clearing in the trees. Standing among the long grass is a person who seems elated to see us. They eagerly move towards us with a warm greeting and caring gaze. "You look tired. Where have you come from? What has your journey been like? Tell me about your friends back at camp." We tell them about the water and our walk. "That sounds terrible. You must be exhausted." This persona is understanding. At the end of the day, understanding ultimately occurs through conversation. It is in this face-to-face space that we begin to see both the other person and their point of view. Understanding does not mean that I have to agree with or accept your position as true for me, nor does it assume that my perspective or experience ought to be true for you. And I say that as somebody who strongly believes in maintaining my Christian identity, even in interfaith spaces. Rather, it welcomes us into a place of respectful inquisitiveness. Do you meditate? What does meditation or reflection, pondering, look like for you? That's fascinating. May I share with you what meditation and prayer looks like for me and why I find it to be such an important part of my day? At this point in the path, we practice both compassionate communication and empathetic listening. On one hand, it means I have to make my views or belief understandable to someone who doesn't share them. And on the other, it means I have to enter into the world of someone's beliefs, experiences, feelings, which may even seem contrary to my own. In understanding, we have the opportunity to learn about one another, to learn what we each believe or hold to be true, and how those views, those principles, those ideas impact our everyday life. In this way, we really begin to experience the beauty of one another. When we turn our face to one another, when we listen and share with each other with empathy, when we ask questions and we listen to one another's answers, we become known. We become real to each other. We see each other as whole persons, as humans. Then the craziest thing might happen. We might actually desire this person's company. Yes, even those with whom we disagree. Our new friend understanding leads us down the path to the other side of the clearing. Here, under the shade of the tree line, we are introduced to the next persona, respect. "I understand you're camping with a rather thirsty group down the trail. It's taken a lot for you to come to us. I don't want to make your quest any more difficult than it already is. How might we best honor your journey and help you on the way?" Now, respect can be tricky. When we ask a group of students, for instance, to develop a community agreement or guidelines for a healthy dialogue space, it's almost inevitable that somebody will propose the rule of be respectful, and it's a good rule. Perhaps, though, a person would propose a golden version of this rule where we treat others as we would have them treat us. But when that rule is proposed, I often respond with this simple question: What does it mean to be respectful to you? And could that be different for somebody else? You see, yes, we want folks to be respectful of one another, absolutely. But respect can mean different things to different people. Part of being respectful, of honoring the dignity of others, of recognizing the humanness of our partner, of our friend, is taking the moment to ask what respect looks like for them. Is it appropriate for me to shake your hand? Thank you for chanting for us. Would it be okay to clap? May I bring a dish when I come for dinner? What are your dietary preferences? Ultimately, when people are being respectful of one another, something significant is happening. They are seeing and validating the humanity of the other person in the ways that the other person or people deem appropriate. Robert Withnow, in his book, America and the Challenge of Religious Diversity, writes that it's wrong to think, I respect you even though I know you're wrong. Rather, we ought to think, because I respect you and because you hold a particular set of beliefs, I am obligated to consider those beliefs differently. Respect opens us up to our blind spots and assumptions. By examining both the intentions and the impact of our words and actions. If we are operating with a desire to be respectful and caring, then we ought to be sure that we are interacting with others in a way that they find respectful and caring. At the end of the day, it's because religious, secular, and spiritual identities are not in essence the same, and because our experiences within those identities are not the same, that engaging in dialogue is worthwhile. The validation of personhood, of shared humanity, empowers us towards our next step on the path. Respect quickly takes us to a campsite not far from the clearing. There we are introduced to acceptance. Acceptance says, I see you as a human being who has come a long way. I see you as someone who thirsts. I see you as someone who is here on behalf of others who are just as thirsty. I see you as someone who can show us the way that we can work together to bring water back to your campsite and even fix the well. Lead us. Acceptance implies that we no longer seek to change the other person, their beliefs, or where they're coming from. It also means that we ought not feel the need to water down or misrepresent ourselves, our beliefs, or where we are coming from. The goal of this relationship isn't to win the person over to our side, nor is it to reduce our dialogue to only that which we can agree upon. Rather, the goal is to accept the fact that we can accomplish great things together, even despite those differences. Social science researcher Diana Eck, who has largely influenced the interfaith work nationally, especially with organizations like Interfaith Youth Corps, observes that often diversity is a reality. It's a fact of our being in community with one another. Now, thinking back to tolerance, simply having diverse people living together ought not to be our culminating achievement. Rather, pluralism is the goal, right? And she defines pluralism as the positive engagement of diversity for the sake of cooperation and social change. A large part of our acceptance is seeing the goodness and potential beauty of the diversity in our communities, despite the fact that our stories, beliefs, and experiences are very different. Acceptance and engagement go hand in hand. If we can serve our community together, then I have come to the point of seeing you for who you are as a vital part of my life in this space. To quote Mr. Fred Rogers, you've made this day special simply by being you. There's no person in the world like you. I like you just the way you are. As we journey back down the path towards the campsite, water jugs and new friends in tow, we exchange stories, we laugh, we cry, we plan how we're going to fix the well together. Caught up in the hope and gratitude of the moment, we are surprised to find a new person has joined our group. I have seen the ways you care for your friends, the way you love them, the way you took risk for this journey. I wish I could be brave like you. I admire your dedication and courage. I'm so glad you're in my life. This is what we call holy envy. It's a term that was originally coined by Christer Stendahl, and certainly if you're familiar with the work of Barbara Brown Taylor, she has a book by this name as well. In this holy envy space, we are willing and able to recognize elements in other religious, secular, or spiritual traditions that we admire or wish in some way could be reflected in our own life, thought, or practice. These elements, as we discussed at the 9 o'clock hour, could be practices, disciplines, idea, art, prayers, songs, rituals, services, equity and justice initiatives, dress, or sincerity of convictions, just to name a few. But it doesn't stop there. In this sense, we begin to see ourselves in the other person and the other person in us. The relationship has moved from being embedded in one's lives to being imprinted on each other's hearts. We find ourselves irreversibly changed because of the goodness we find in this person who was once a stranger to us. This form of envy isn't jealousy or desire. It's admiration. It's connectedness. If empathy is putting ourselves into the shoes of another person to feel what they are feeling, to have holy or even human envy is to see that our experiences and stories are inextricably connected, even though they may seem vastly different. We become necessary to one another in a very deeply human way, not unlike the African philosophy of Ubuntu. In his memoir, No Future Without Forgiveness, the late Desmond Tutu writes, "Ubuntu is very difficult to render into Western language. It speaks of the very essence of being human. When we want to give high praise to somebody, we say, hey, he or she has Ubuntu. Then you are generous, you are hospitable, you are friendly, caring, and compassionate. You share what you have. It is to say, my humanity is inextricably bound up in yours. We belong in a bundle of life. As we seek after peace, we inevitably find our very life and well-being is bound up in the lives and well-being of others. I am because you are." In his granddaughter's book, Everyday Ubuntu, Desmond Tutu also notes, "At its most simple, the teaching of this proverb of Ubuntu is similar to the golden rule found in most faith teachings, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But one who has Ubuntu goes a step beyond that. It's not only our actions we are called to keep track of, but our very way of being in the world. How we live, talk, and walk in the world is just as much a statement of our character as our actions. One with Ubuntu is careful to walk in the world as one who recognizes the infinite worth of everyone with whom they come in contact. It is not simply a way of behaving, it is indeed a way of being." As I try and wrap my mind around this, I'm grateful for the imagery and challenge that the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. offers to us in his letter, Why We Can't Wait, often referred to as the letter from Birmingham Jail. He writes, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." Whether we see ourselves bound together in Ubuntu, in that bundle of life, or in the single garment of destiny, this is a call to understand one another, to cultivate appreciative knowledge. This is a call to value one another, to cultivate positive attitudes. This is a call to learn how to live together in peace and work together for the peace of all, to cultivate meaningful relationships that ultimately find life and love in the other person. I have a note here that says, if they still seem interested, say this. We'll go for it. Research tells us that values, beliefs, and convictions are processed in a different section of our brain than simply facts and data, which is why it's difficult to change somebody's mind or even get them to listen when an issue, especially the political, enters the sacred realm of the brain. But that's where relationships come in. As allies to one another, and especially for those of us with privilege, we have the responsibility to be in those hard conversation spaces, in those long game approaches towards listening and understanding, truth-telling, and advocating on behalf of those who are systemically oppressed, marginalized, and attacked. Because the risk for us looks different, our lives are not at stake. I have the privilege to opt out of those conversations because it's not my lived reality every day. For me and those like me, white, cis, Christian men, I invite you to consider when your own learning in the journey, when your mind was changed, when your worldview was expanded, what did that journey look like? Could you come alongside of someone, perhaps a very different or very difficult someone, on their own journey? Because again, we have the ability, I have the responsibility to try. In the pursuit of our common humanity, we have to turn our face towards one another. Even at a time when unity and understanding seem like an impossibility, on a local and personal level, chances are there are things we do share in common: worries, anxieties, hopes, dreams, caring for elderly loved ones, medical expenses, living expenses, online classes, keeping a business afloat, college applications, finding a new job, balancing all the work-life stress of having kids at home, our love of knitting, the future of the Detroit Lions. These are starting points. We can have common goals and projects that we work together on, even while maintaining our distinctiveness, even while recognizing there are significant disagreements between us. As we say in interfaith, we don't have to water down our identity or core beliefs in order to listen, to learn, to hear one another's stories, experiences, and convictions. The interfaith agenda, this path towards peace, offers us this challenge. Can we choose to live outside of our tribe? Can we choose to see beyond the other? Can we choose love and life in order to overcome fear and hate? Can we choose to love so strongly that we see our neighbor in ourselves and ourselves in our neighbor as a part of a common humanity? Can we choose to find the water together? I'll close with this quote from Frederick Buechner. Your life and my life flow into each other as wave flows into wave. Unless there is peace and joy and freedom for you, there can be no real peace or joy or freedom for me. To see reality not as we expect it to be, but as it is to see that unless we live for each other and in and through each other, we do not really live very satisfactorily, that there can really be life only when there really is, in just this sense, love.